All right. Okay, now let's do the scoot up thing again. We got a lot of people if you're more than two rows back, scoot up a little bit, come out of the corners and scoot towards the center, and we got tables here you can fill in, and just in these areas would be awesome. You scoot chairs up if you just want to scoot the chairs up or whatever. Y'all are way back there. So come on up. Thank you. Don't make me come over there. I'll pull this car over. Okay, so here's what I want to do with this one, our last Wednesday night of the year, is to debrief and discuss a little bit. How many of you were either here for the conversation with David Smalley that Sunday afternoon, or you have listened to it online? Let me see a show of hands. A lot have, but a lot haven't too. Okay, so I want to go into a couple of things. Now, if you came, could you grab those doors at the back too? If you came, I want you to understand the mindset behind what we did, why we did it the way we did it. So one format would have been to do it the way he's comfortable with, which is the discussion. We could have brought in a couple of chairs out there and set them up here and both been mic'd and just talked. I've already done that with him for about between five and seven hours on the podcast. So what David typically does on those podcasts, if you listen to them, you've noticed this, is that once you start to, it's his show, and by the way, I am intentionally very respectful on his show. He guides the conversations. If he wants to switch topics, that's his prerogative. Like, I don't make an issue of that. Part of what I want people and his listeners to know is I consider atheism so handicapped in the conversation that I'm happy for him to have all the advantages. In my opinion, he is so handicapped from the beginning, the fact that he's trying to defend atheism, that I am more than happy to give him his show. And so he distracts, he moves, changes topics and all that kind of stuff on a regular basis. I am happy to have that conversation that way. And he can go wherever he wants to with it. That is part of his deal, is when there's a good answer coming back, then he jumps to a different topic. If you were here Sunday, that afternoon, you saw him do that at least three very distinct times. That when he was in big trouble, he just went to a totally new topic. This is not an uncommon technique, so to speak. Now, that's fine for his show, but I don't go on his show for the same reason I had him come here. The main reason I wanted him to come here was to educate you, was to train and educate my people. That's why I had him here. If I thought it hadn't have been advantageous to my people to hear him, I just wouldn't have done that. I'd just done another podcast with him. But I wanted you guys to experience something different. As I understand it, a number of people felt real anxiety about being here. And in fact, a number of people didn't come because they felt so anxious about being here because of what they were afraid of. And part of what I want our people, you, to know is there's no reason at all to be afraid of questions, of doubting, of even the leaders of different groups that are that of different beliefs and stuff like that. I mean, I want that to be something that you get. That's the main reason why I did the show, his show, in the first place. The where it came from was me throwing down a gauntlet on Easter Sunday, saying I can't get any of the atheist or free thinking groups in Tyler or in Smith County to invite me to come speak or share or just be bombarded with questions, whatever they want to do. They can dictate the format. I'll just show up. And not a single one of them will let me come, will invite me to come. And again, one of them has forbidden me from coming. Like, they won't even let me just come to the meeting. And so the response to that gauntlet was not anyone in Smith County, not one in anyone in East Texas, not anyone in Texas, but a California podcaster, David Smalley, getting word from a gentleman who is in our audience who regularly attends, who is an atheist, and who contacted David, and David contacted me. David, on that first podcast, if you've heard it, said, oh, I'll find somebody in your area who will let you come do that. I'll at least find somebody in Texas. So you'll know I have still not been contacted by any of those audiences, by a single group. So just so you'll know, like, if you've got this mind, like, we Christians, we're so close-minded in our thinking, and we're just really rigid, and we don't really engage with hard questions. Understand, that's not the Christian population only. The atheist population is also afraid of having their beliefs questioned. Some of you didn't want to come that Sunday because you didn't want to hear something that would make you doubt. Believe me when I tell you that's this part of the same reason why they don't want me to come to their group meetings, is because they don't want to doubt. They find great comfort in their beliefs. And so when I learned early on that I don't have to be afraid of their questions, we either worship a God of truth or we don't. If we don't, we need to stop worshiping the God we worship. If he is a God of truth, then he's not afraid of questions. If you know you can win the battle of truth, then you have no reason to be afraid. Now, you may not be prepared to have a personal conversation with someone like that. That's a separate topic. There's plenty of different conversations I could have or not have with different people, and I wouldn't be prepared to have it. That's just a matter of training or expertise or whatever. I could not have a PhD conversation with somebody on some of these topics, like even in the atheist world. I can't have that conversation. That doesn't mean it can't be had. It just means I may not be the right person to do it. So I grew up with educators. That's not hard for me. So I want to give you my, and if you, David, if you can get some verses ready, or if you've got access to that, a couple of verses that are my key verses when I'm engaging with someone like this. One is obviously 1 Peter 3, 15 and 16. So 1 Peter 3, 15 and 16 are vital passages when it comes to these conversations. This is actually where we get the word apologetic. Theology is broken into three headings. Dogmatics, or doctrine, meaning conversation between believers, or even arguments and debates between believers. Then there is ethics, meaning how to apply theology to right living. And the third one is apologetics, meaning a theological conversation with a non-believer. Those are different things. I don't bring up the same conversations with I'm not going to discuss dispensationalism with a non-believer unless they want to bring something like that up. I'm not going to talk about the age of the earth with a non-believer unless they want to bring that up. I'm not going to talk about the rapture and the end times unless they want to bring that up for some reason. Those are all doctrine questions. Church policy and the role of women in ministry and all those different types of things are great key conversations that Christians need to be having, but not with non-believers. So they tell me what topics they need to talk about, the non-believers do. And it's usually the same 5 to 10 topics that you hear about over and over again. But notice, so with your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy. So you never, in a conversation of apologetics, you never back off the fact of who Jesus Christ is and what that means. You don't soft pedal that. You don't water that down. You don't any of that. God is God. Jesus Christ is his son. This is an absolute standard that there's no reason feel no need to back off on. I try to always, if you hear me discuss with someone, I try to always work in a conversation about Jesus Christ, because that's what I'm taught here. Always being prepared to make a defense. The word defense there is apologia, meaning reason. A rational defense. Be prepared to make a rational defense to anyone who asks for the reason of the hope that is in you. With gentleness and respect, keep going. Having a good conscience so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame. So notice, so if you were one of those who was like, man, I really wish I wanted you to prove him wrong. Like I wanted you to get in some good punches. I want to see a little blood flow, right? You're thinking in terms of that there's somehow a victory in proving an atheist wrong. That's typically not a victory, nor is it really necessary. There's a person's soul on the line. Proving them wrong isn't likely to help with that. Recently, what is today, Wednesday? So last night, I was hanging out with two members of our church who were there when I used to travel and speak as an atheist. I wasn't an atheist, but I would travel and speak as an atheist. I learned very quickly you couldn't do it with adults, because adults will get so angry they can't handle it, which is part of why we didn't do Q&A from the audience, because I know David's skill set at really ticking people off. This is one of his things, is to get people angry, especially Christians. It is the main way he reaches out to his atheist audience is to make Christians look foolish or out of control. Now, he has a problem because the handful of us who have been on his show who aren't touched by it, who aren't affected by it, who don't get angry, who don't lose their temper, who don't get frustrated. And he has plenty of examples of Christians who do that, by the way, who get on his show and they think they're going to prove him wrong. And then he just makes them mad, which is his deal. And they start yelling at him on the podcast, which is embarrassing. It's just, anyway, because they think that's why they're there. They don't understand apologetics at all. It's embarrassing to the faith to hear them sometimes. And the problem is those, so you will know, so it's not just David Smalley's soul that's on the line, but each one of his podcasts is downloaded, each one with me so far has been downloaded over 120,000 times. And a number of his followers have already reached out to me, now not hundreds, but a few, have reached out to me, and they're in search of a pastor. They may be atheists, but they still want someone to care and to listen. It's amazing how little really it takes to help them feel cared about. So that's another reason why I do that, is to just, so there people will know, like that passage says, there is a reasonable answer for these questions. Their conversion is between them and God, not me and them. But I have the opportunity to show them that believing in God is rational. You don't have to be crazy. You don't have to be delusional. You don't have to be needy. You don't have to be pathetic. You don't have to be unintelligent to believe in God. And in fact, I can show why it is more reasonable to believe in a creator God than to not. You can decide to believe that there is no creator God. The reason I cannot agree with that is because I lack the faith. It requires too much defiance of just raw statistics and mathematics. And I'm not willing, it is unfeasible, feasible to me. I cannot make my brain accept, just like David talked about in the last podcast, so your truck is white, you cannot choose to believe it's red. Right. And I cannot choose to believe there is no God, given the preponderance, the overwhelming evidence of an intelligence. It's not even close. If we get to it, I'll talk about that before we run out of time. Was there any questions or, yes, sir?
I wasn't there at the event, but you're saying, did he appear to be fairly well welcomed?
Okay, I'll get to that. So the second thing, actually, I'll go ahead and comment on that now, since you asked. So that you know, David, we came, we set up here. That's why I did the format the way we did. And honestly, the reason I didn't do a straight up debate format is because he's not good at that. And I did not want to embarrass him. I did not think I could avoid embarrassing him in a debate format. And what would best educate you guys would be, and that I thought would give him the best chance to feel like he could say however he wanted to say it, was to do this 10 minute answer format. He answers for 10 minutes. I answer for 10 minutes on whatever question, and he would choose some of the questions and I would choose some of the questions. And all of the questions came from me or him or members of his listening group audience or people from the church. And so that was the way that's set up. And he had 10 minutes and I had 10 minutes. So we'll discuss maybe a little bit more of that in detail here in a minute. I will tell you, he and his wife and his mother were, beyond blown away at how welcome they were. They came expecting to be treated like an enemy, like enemies. And they were treated like VIPs, like they were the most important people here that night. And all three of them noted it. All three of them were stunned by it. None of the three of them, including the mother, who is a Christian, had ever been to a church where she felt that welcomed. David Smalley, activist atheist, at dinner said, "I wish my mother lived in this town so she could go to y'all's church." That's how they were treated. If he was in town, I think he would probably visit our church, even as an atheist. He could not. We totally ripped away all his. We did what First Peter says. He can't now go and get back on his podcast and say, "Those Christians, they're all like this." There was that one church. They're not like that. That's what he has to do now for the rest of his life. And he already has three or four of us. And as I've told you guys, the atheist world has really attacked him recently, because the big division in the atheist world right now between conservatives and liberals, and it's massive and it's ugly, and they aren't especially the conservative side. They're the scientific, amoral, we're just animal side. The whole point of being an atheist is so that there's no one to tell you what to do. And the leftist liberal side is always doing this to them, preachy. You should be saving water and saving the whales, and you should be protecting this group and that group, and you should be... And this conservative group over here is like, man, we left the church to get away from junk like this. And now you're getting all lectury and preachy with us? Who made you God? Literally, that's the conversations that are happening. I thought we all agreed there wasn't a God, but you sure seem to think you're my God. I mean, it's a... And they can't even be on stage with each other. There's a really cool video right now where two of them get on stage to try to kind of reconcile this, and they last about 45 seconds, and then they are screaming at each other at the tops of their lungs. I was like, it reminds me of Christianity 1,700 years ago, right? I mean, St. Nicholas is punching the heretics, right? So yes, ma'am? He lives in California. His mother lives in Dallas. So he had come to visit his mother for Thanksgiving and said, on his own dime, he drove down here with them and came. And I mean, it was, and by the way, he posted it verbatim. The only thing he did was add Carl Sagan's little blue dot speech at the end, which, as he called it, the nearest thing the atheists have to a prayer. And it's a prayer. Anyway, I put on my Facebook when I said, like, feel free to break into how great thou art at the end of this little thing by Carl Sagan, because it's, you expect Carl Sagan to break into how great thou art at the end of it. Anyway, so the answer is he was stunned by the level of welcome and love that he experienced, that his wife experienced. I mean, I sat up here with him for a few minutes. People came up and spoke to him. There was somebody else. There were people stopped talking to his wife, people sitting and talking to his mom. They were stunned. It's just so you'll know, stunned. He asked me if he could come back at Christmas. I was like, that's kind of soon, actually. So here's what I've invited him to do, so you'll know. What I invited him to do was to come back at Christmas and maybe sit around the campfire with a bunch of guys and let us just hang out with him. Like, no need to debate. We don't need to discuss. Let's just hang out. Now, having spent about 9 hours with David, he has never once referenced his father. Not once. There's still a total unknown void there to me. He has never talked about him to me or to the other guy who was here that night, who's been on his show a couple times. So there's... He talked about his mom. I don't remember him talking about his dad, did he? That there was no dad? We'll have to look that up then. Because that would be cool if he did, so I could ask him. I could say, hey, you mentioned this in your podcast. So anyway, we'll see. When you're talking to a non-believer, Acts chapter 17 is the passage. Acts chapter 17, starting in verse about 16, when Paul goes to Athens. This is a great model for if you ever talk to somebody with a different view. Just like the Apostle Paul, this is Paul practicing apologetics as one, obviously one of the greatest apologists of all time. The Apostle Paul meets with the men of Athens and sits there on the hill of Ares on Mars Hill and has a discussion with them. And this little thing shows just what a genius Paul was and how good he was at engaging with them. He quotes their own philosophers. He has read their material. Like, he literally, so this is, he, the Apostle Paul, quotes the writings of Greek philosophers and Greek artists and Greek poets, because Paul knew what these Greeks believed. He had read their stuff. The first line, when he stands up in front of them and says, men of Athens, this is a common phrase from Plato. Of course, the Apostle Paul was well educated enough to have read Plato. And so he gets up and he starts quoting. He quotes Plato. He then goes, I mean, it's beautiful to watch him. He uses their language. He uses their context. He's not pushy. He's not arrogant. He's not weird. He's not rude. He's not even really argumentative. He presents a case. It is a sound case, especially for the Greek polytheist or the Greek skeptic. It's amazing to watch how he handles it. And this is my model anytime I'm talking to someone with a different belief. What can I agree with them on? Where can we be on the same page? There's no reason to start by poking at each other. And that version, what we experienced that night. So let me give you a couple of things that he threw out there that we might need to comment on that might help you out. A couple of things he threw out there. One is, which is one of his favorites, is to default to slavery in the Bible. Okay? Did any of you? So if he starts losing, he will say, well, but what about slavery in the Bible? It's a pretty quick one for him. Now, part of what's valuable about that for his argument is slavery in the Bible is a very complex conversation. It'd take 2 or 3 hours to really discuss it and do it justice. So he knows perfectly well we don't have 2 or 3 hours, but it will plant a seed in each one of us going like, yeah, what about slavery in the Bible? And he'll just sit back there and kind of hover as this like, yeah, hey, what about that? No one ever reads any books about it. No one ever does any research on it. It just kind of hovers back there as a problem. And he knows that. And so I want to make sure you understand what we're talking about when we're talking about biblical. I taught a sermon on it just about a year ago. I took a whole Sunday and taught on slavery, which, again, stuff like that really weirds him out when he's like, no, Christians won't ever talk about this. And I'm like, actually, I just preached about it not that long ago. So he was, one of his favorites is the story of Jephthah. He loves to rub Christians' faces in the story of Jephthah. And so the first time when he was like, what do you think about the Jephthah? And I was like, actually, I'm like 4 chapters from Jephthah. I'll be there just a few weeks. This is a good conversation. He's like, you're going to preach about Jephthah from the pulpit? I'm like, absolutely. Well, it's in the Bible, isn't it? Well, we'll talk about it. And anyway, it's cool to work for a church when people aren't afraid of me doing that kind of stuff. So he goes to slavery. So let's discuss this just for a second. When you hear slavery, you picture Deep South antebellum racial slavery. That is not the same thing that the slavery in the Bible is. Slavery in the Bible comes from 3 or 4 different directions. And amazingly, slaves have legal protection in the Bible. They have different opportunities, different times when they are either automatically sent back, they are either, or they have a choice. What makes slavery evil, ladies and gentlemen, is not having someone work for you without pay. That is not evil. That is a worldwide experience throughout almost all of history. The example I use regularly on this topic is, the little Korean madman decides to send a nuclear weapon and he shuts down all the electricity in the United States. And David self shows up at my, I always use David as my example for this because I'm hoping this is exactly what would happen if this happens. Is David self shows up at my door a couple of days later and says, hey, any chance I could come live here? I'll work. I'll do whatever you need me to do. I just need a place to stay and I'm going to need food. And I brought some stuff with me, but it's not going to last. I need some stuff. I brought some supplies, but is there a way I could work and you would provide for me? Is that slavery? He's working for free. Just room and board is all he gets. And works, he'd be working hard. Everybody would be just to try to stay alive. Is that slavery? Okay. What makes slavery evil is when a slave is not protected with the freedom to leave. That's where, now, and so David might say a year, be like, you know what, I'm sick of this, I don't like you anymore, I'm leaving. And I'd probably say, well, you're not taking any of my stuff with you. And you might say, well, then you're kind of dooming me. Well, that's not my concept, that's not my responsibility. You came, you worked, I took care of you, you're ready to leave now. If you're going to leave, it's not my job to continue to provide for you. That is the harsh reality of most of human experience throughout most of human history. That's hard for us to wrap our brain around because we think we aren't slaves because we get a check. We get a piece of paper rather than actual food and supplies and room and board. We just use that check to buy those things, but somehow that makes a gap in our brain that doesn't make any sense at all. It is not evil. Slavery is not, if you mean indentured servanthood. Servanthood where I work or live as your servant is not evil. It's only evil if I'm not allowed to leave. That's when it can become evil. For most people in the Bible, teaching through Ruth and Boaz right now, remember what I said last Sunday, Ruth and Naomi hope someone will take Ruth in as a concubine. That would be more than they could dream for at the time we meet them in Ruth chapter 1. That's not a worse condition for her to be brought on as a slave wife or a servant wife. That's what a concubine was. She had a lot of protection. And by the way, Jewish law offered protection for servants and slaves. Essentially, no other legal system in history did for hundreds more years later. So you would go, but this is God. Couldn't God have just outlawed all slavery when he was on earth? Yes, and he didn't. We don't necessarily have an explanation for why not, but understand that, of course, God could end any social injustice or any social evil. He has decided to give us a certain amount of choice and leeway in these decisions, though, as cultures and as societies. Why? In case by case, it feels very hard for us that he would do that. But if he's going to give us freedom, there's consequences for that. So the issue of slavery is a very complex historical conversation that really is much bigger than just the Bible. We can go through and study all the different passages where slaves are actually offered legal protection by God. But when we use, the problem is in English, we use the word slave and we picture someone bound by chains in a ship being kidnapped from Africa and brought to the United States. That is not the biblical concept of slavery. The closest thing to that in the Bible is conquest by war. That when you defeated a people, they were then your servants. They were then your slaves. Meaning they now worked for you. But there you're talking about conquest. Sometimes the Jews were slaves, sometimes other people were slaves. In that situation, again, we shouldn't picture people in chains being whipped. What we picture is people who are responsible, legally responsible, that the conquering government has declared that by law, these people are now servants to these people. It's exactly what Jesus' people experienced under the Romans, and that every other race of people did throughout all of human history until about 150 years ago, when people started saying, culturally speaking, we shouldn't have to do this anymore. Now, we have what's called fossil fuel slavery, which is we don't need slaves because we have fossil fuels. But it would be very quickly. So you ask yourself, somebody, if I go to the go to Asia and some guy pedals me on his bike across town and I give him a little money, is he my servant? If I gave him food instead, would that somehow make you feel worse about it? If I gave him food rather than cash? You see how what we've done is we've just become comfortable with the idea of the exchange of money, and usually throughout history, food and shelter was considered what people got for working for somebody. So what are your any questions or comments or thoughts on that? And by the way, that's a very simplistic, already a simplistic shorthand conversation on it. But already you can see how to just throw out biblical slavery is not really cool. Because he knows that there's an emotional effect. Yes, ma'am.
So if you're conquered, what's the difference between something like indigenous?
Yeah. So it's the even people conquered and captured as a slave by the Israelite people had protection by law. There were things you could do and couldn't do. There was a sense in which they were property for the time you had them and a sense in which they were not. They weren't property in that they weren't property in the same way your shoe is your property. They were property. They weren't even really property in the same way that your goat was your property. They were property. Notice that, for example, in the Ten Commandments, multiple times, slaves are offered certain rights. For example, Sabbath. The Sabbath applied to slaves and servants. So did the gleaning laws, which I've been studying because we're looking at Ruth. Those applied to servants and strangers in the land. There were legal consequences that if you harmed even your own servants, you could be found guilty by law for harming them. Then there were laws like that every few years you had to give them the opportunity to leave your service. That may have applied to even conquest slaves. A woman taken in battle, here's what's wild. So a woman taken, there's very specific laws that if the Jews came in and conquered a land and a man saw a woman and said, hey, I really like her, He was not allowed to have sex with her for a month. So he could take her, no rape, no pillaging for Jews. They weren't allowed to do that. He could take her in, and a month later he was allowed to marry her if he still wanted to. Now, talk about, I mean, that allows everything to calm down. That allows everybody to chill. Like, you know, do I really want to marry this lady? Or was this just the heat of battle? And if he does marry her, she then has rights as his slave wife, but his wife. She has rights. And that's it's a big, and by the way, if he sends her, he's not allowed to give her to somebody else. He has to set her free. If at the end of a month, if he chooses not to marry her, he has to set her free. And that was a woman conquered as an enemy. So if a Canaanite woman was taken in battle, there were laws to protect her. That's no one else, by the way, no one else did that. Even the Hammurabi Code does not offer that type of protection for women. And it's the next best thing to a legal. It's why Moses is considered the greatest lawgiver in the history of mankind. It's why when you go to our legal, when you go to Congress, they have statues. There are no statues of Jesus in Washington, D.C. I never found a single one. But Moses is everywhere because he is the greatest lawgiver in all of history. And everyone understood that. So anyway, yes?
In any of your discussions, did he offer any non-feelings-based reason for why he believes slavery is wrong?
No. I don't get off on that one. He brought it up here. I just moved along. Unless I've got an hour or two to discuss slavery with somebody, I'm not going to bother. And I'll just say, like on the podcast, I would just say, David, that's a much longer conversation. If you want to set aside an entire podcast just to talk about slavery, I'll do it. But I'm not going to have a 10-minute conversation with you.
Did he articulate any reason for why he believes people are valuable?
No.
As a whole?
Yes, because he's a humanist. Because he thinks they're valuable.
Asserted, but not justified.
Asserted, but not justified. Absolutely. Good, yes. We don't choose to believe things. So this is a switch dial conversation, because one thing is true doesn't mean its opposite is always true. So the question was that came up in the last podcast, and I don't want to stay here long because I want to get back to that, the debrief that afternoon, but is that he got really. And this was just because he wanted to talk with me about this. I mean, it had nothing to do with the podcast. He wanted to talk with me about his belief that you don't choose what you believe. I don't know if he chooses to believe that or not, but I actually was like, so is this something you have no choice but to believe? Because what's weird is I don't believe it, and I feel like we have the same amount of evidence, and yet we have two different conclusions. But so you need to know that David Smalley and many atheists who won't espouse this, and he won't say it yet, he will soon with me, I think, believe that all of us are atheists. That's what we're really atheists. And anyone who says they're not an atheist, they just haven't heard enough truth yet to know that what they believe is wrong. Or they're not willing to face the consequences of admitting they're an atheist. Those are the two things that keep people from acknowledging the fact they're an atheist. The fact that only about 5% of the population of the world espouses atheism, it does not seem to trouble them. That's like, you know, so all the rest of us are the delusional ones, and your 5% are you're the rational ones. To me, that seems dangerous. I mean, that seems like, should at least make you wonder if we're the ones who are wrong, but hey, that's not real common. It's very handy to not believe you choose what you believe, because then other people are responsible for your beliefs, not you. So, Ellie pointed out that at dinner, if you heard him during his little humanist sermon, so when I showed him that his problem of evil argument is one of the big wide open problems with the problem of evil. Is that if there is no God, there is still evil. So there being no God doesn't take away evil. Make sense? So if there's a God, there are earthquakes and there's toe fungus and there's cancer and there's all these different things, right? If there is no God, there is still earthquakes and toe fungus and all these other and cancer and all these other problems. I say toe fungus because he always throws that in his list. Anyway, so because he's a comedian by training. That's what actually he did for a living before he found this gig. But And so I said, so if there is no God, then who is responsible for my suffering? So I suffer. I face hardships. People around me die. I get sick. I get tired. I mean, all these awful things have happened to me in my lifetime. Whose fault is that if there is no God? Some of you may have been here. What's the answer? Anybody remember? My parents. It's not me. I didn't choose to be here. Did my parents know this was a hard world? Did they know there was such a thing as suffering? Did they know there was abuse? Did they know those things happen when they had me? 25 years old. Do you think by then they knew that? I think they did. And yet they chose to have me anyway. Why would you do that? How is that not evil? Hey, we're in a concentration camp. Let's have kids. You don't do that. So why do I have kids? Because I believe our suffering has purpose. I believe our suffering has an eternal impact. I believe that our suffering, I can have children knowing that they're suffering and that there's abuse and that there's rebellion and that there's awful things and there are evil people out there, because I believe in the redemption of that suffering, because there is a God who is going to give meaning to that suffering someday. If there is no God, to have children is to be a messed up, self-absorbed person. He gave two quick answers. One, I really wasn't thinking about it at the time. Okay, so in your ignorance, you abused your child by bringing, he has a daughter. So in your ignorance is your claim to excuse for bringing your daughter into a concentration camp. So you're just a narcissistic, self-absorbed, evil person. And one, he didn't say it here. What he said here was, and it just goes to show the power of the genetic drive to have offspring. The way he said it on one podcast was, sex feels good. So what do we call somebody who, because sex feels good, brings someone into a torturous existence so that they can have sexual gratification? Is that really where David wants to go with that? Because you wanted sexual gratification, you brought a child into this torture. That you say that if there is a God, that God must be evil because he allows all this suffering, and yet you brought a child into it knowing exactly what you were putting them in? This is something, so you'll know, the atheist mind worldview is dead here. There is, as of yet, they have not worked out an answer that is not embarrassingly bad to this question. So were y'all here? What did David do? He gave two quick little answers, right? They were both bad. And then he did an 8-minute sermon on humanism, right? Which, by the way, was one of the weirdest definitions of humanism. I mean, essentially, it was nothing to do with humanism. It was Christianity without a God. What he did was he gave an 8-minute sermon on Christianity without there being a God, which, of course, makes no sense. And I could look at it on the audience, and even the, like, 8 atheists sitting on the front row, I didn't have to say anything. They were going, I mean, they were all like, wait, none of them had followed a word he had said. It made no sense what he had said. And additionally, it doesn't matter, even if he's right. So you had a child so that they would improve the world. That's what you hoped. They would come and leave their mark on the world and make the world a better place. So for the sake of your political agenda, you brought your child into a concentration camp. That's not much better than the sex feels good argument, to be perfectly honest. So you just needed someone to help you in your agenda, so you brought them into hell. Because that's what he says the world is like. So there's no good answer here. But I didn't need to comment on that one. That was self-evident by the end of his conversation. There was one other thing. Oh, in that he said, by the way, in his little mini humanism sermon, he said, when I leave this world, I want to leave it a much better place. And my daughter Ellie caught that instantly and was like, doesn't he believe he's not leaving this world? Like, isn't that a core tenet of being an atheist, is I'm not going anywhere? Yet he uses terminology like that all the time.
You can see, like, his Christian background come out.
Yeah. Yeah, his Christian background comes out. I'm not even sure he's not a Christian. I'll be honest with you. I mean, he was baptized as a believer at one point. I'm not convinced that he's not a believer. That's why he is such a reasonable atheist, is because he's actually maybe did have a conversion experience. And just each, by the way, each one of he and his wife, what happened was, how many of you went through a phase somewhere between 12 and 25 where you really, really seriously doubted the kind of whole Christianity thing and church and all that kind of stuff? Any of you? The rest of you are liars. Or you still haven't had it yet. You haven't gone through your doubting phase. It is a, of course, as you're developing your identity and you're trying to distinguish yourself from your parents, especially if your parents are allegedly or nominally Christians, of course you're going to have that happen. That's one of my favorite questions for atheist groups is, when do you doubt your beliefs or lack thereof? I mean, when you have a child, when you go in and you hold your baby for the first time, do you go, there really may be a God? I mean, surely you do that, right? Because I know when I'm sitting across from a client and she tells me about her sexual abuse at the hands of her dad for 10 years, I'm going, maybe there's not a God. That's a rational thing to do when you face that. Reasonable, open-minded, intelligent people doubt their own beliefs at times. That's a reasonable thing to do. That's why another one who came and met with me, when he said, how sure are you that there is a God? I was like, I'm only like 98% sure you're here. Like, I could be strapped down in a bed in a hospital having a schizophrenic breakdown right now, and it would feel like this. Like, none of us can be 100% sure of anything. I mean, we could be in a matrix, right? I mean, it could be your dream, and you're an inception, and you're incepting my dream right now, and I'm none of this. Because my memory's so bad, I can't remember how this conversation started 10 minutes ago. Maybe this is a dream. I can't remember how I got here. Like, that's, listen, the truth is, as humans, we can't know anything with 100% certainty. That's part of what it means to be human. Anytime you get asked, how certain are you of something, you can't say 100% certain. You're claiming something that humans can't claim if you do. It's okay to say, yeah, I mean, there's a chance that this is all delusional. All delusional. Now, there's consequences for that, by the way. You don't just get to say that and walk away. There are consequences for saying that. But I am convinced that the most rational answer is that there is a God and that Jesus Christ is his son, and the way that it's presented through Scripture is the most rational answer. I believe it because I'm rational, not in opposition to my rationality. I don't remember what got me started on that. I don't remember how I got here. Is this another dream? I need a top to spin or something like that. Sorry, you had a hand up over here. Yes, ma'am.
So, Christians make it very evident what drives them, and that's the whole purpose of belief system. So what does he say drives him?
Yeah, so if you were here, what did he say drives him? Love. He loves us. He said that. He said, this is the most Christian thing I'm going to say tonight. And it wasn't even close to the most Christian thing he said that night. But he said, this is the most Christian thing I'm going to say tonight is, I love you, and I want you to have the best life possible. And so what's funny is, he claims to not have this agenda. He's not interested. He doesn't care about converting us. Right. But he does. Because, now, it's rational. He believes what he believes is the truth, and he believes what we believe isn't the truth. And it is unkind to let someone believe a lie. No, it's not hurt. Well, it doesn't seem to hurt us. He would say it does, because we're believing so. He thinks we're all Christians because we're afraid of hell, by the way. That's another one of his. We're afraid of rejection of friends and family, or we're afraid of hell. And I told him, I was like, honestly, I wish I was more motivated by hell. My theology on hell is so bad that I'm like, he wanted to ask me those questions on one of the podcasts about hell. And I was like, honestly, when I've studied it, I walk away going, I totally understand why there's so many different views on hell, even among doctrinal Christians. Like, when you have someone like C.S. Lewis saying, then probably it's not so clear that it's obvious. Yes, I believe there is a hell. Yes, I believe it lasts forever. Yes, I believe it is for torment of God's enemies. What is not clear to me is what the individual condition of the individual human, even the lost human in hell, is. I don't know that. I don't feel comfortable and confident to teach that. And so I wish I was more motivated by my fear of you going to hell. But I just can't motivate myself a lot with negatives. If I could, I'd lose weight. I have such a hard time motivating myself with like, oh, listen, my vision's going bad. It's probably because my blood sugar's out of whack and I'm going to develop prediabetes. I shouldn't eat this donut because it's bad. And I still eat the donut. I cannot motivate myself well with negatives. I can get really excited, though, about the positives. That's part of how I teach the way that I teach. It's hard for me to teach hellfire and brimstone. I believe it's real, and I believe it is a true danger, and I believe that we should be motivated by that. I think we should be willing to cross heaven and earth no matter what it takes to save someone from hell. I really do. It's just hard for me to keep that on my forefront when I'm going like, but this life is so good and so abundant. Like, that's what I want to drag you with is the truth of how awesome this is and how rational it is. It just makes sense. Sorry, anyway. Okay, the reason that, yes, thank you, you're right. Thank you. The reason they became atheists is because when they were teenagers and they started asking their first questions, their parents attacked them over it. Including the mom who was here. She told us that at dinner. She said, I made a huge mistake. When David started asking questions, I just attacked him. I went on the offense and I said he was going to go to hell, and I did all kinds of awful things to try to keep him from asking these. She said, I was so afraid of the questions. David at dinner actually said, Mom, you need to write a book about what to do when your child decides they're an atheist or starts asking questions. I was like, that'd be great. You'd probably save a lot of people from becoming atheists if you would do that. Because instead, when a child comes and says, what about this? When you're able to say, that is a great question. I've never thought about that one. Let's do some research. I'll bet someone else has asked that question in the history of mankind. You're probably not the first one to think of that question. I'll bet someone else has asked it. And I will tell you, if anyone's asked it, 7,000 people have written a book in response to it. They're out there, probably starting back within a few hundred years of Jesus walking the planet. There have been books written. A lot of the questions we discussed were being debated by the second, if you don't count the Bible, which is debating it, but certainly by the second generation of Christians, these questions were being asked and discussed and thought about already and have continued to be nonstop all along the way. Sometimes they come to great conclusions. You know what? We've come to a conclusion. This is the answer. We're good. But a lot of times, we're still a lot of work to be done on some of these. It's fascinating. There's nothing boring about this. There's nothing rigid, really, honestly, in the thinking. But he did throw out a couple of verses I want to comment on. One was Psalm 121, 7. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep you going out and you're coming in from this time forth and forevermore. Psalm 121, 7. He says, well, clearly God is not keeping his promises here. So you've heard me talk about this. And it's really, that honestly, he's been doing this long enough now that I feel like this has now become almost disingenuous. He knows there is a good answer to this question. But he still keeps asking it. So here's the problem. He was raised to read King James only, which is why a lot of times when he quotes the Bible, he quotes King James. The King James is not a terrible translation, but it is usually a terrible translation for us to read because it's not written in your language. You don't speak the King's English. So reading it in the King's English is really not different from reading it in Swahili if you don't read Swahili. You are just as likely going to miss key meanings, key words, and a lot of the words mean something different than they did in the time it was written back then. On top of the fact that the three best ancient copies of the New Testament have been found since the King James translation. So it's not as good a translation as the ones we have now. I get how if you grew up with it, you feel comfortable with it or whatever, but honestly, you probably don't understand whole passages that you've read because it meant something different to them. Literally, the English words meant different things then. So it can be really confusing to us when we look at that because we're not speaking the same language. But one of the things that I had to tell David and that I've shared with you guys many times, is that you cannot read the Bible as an unsophisticated person. You have to at least have enough sophistication to know what you're reading. The Bible is not a magic book. You can't sit it up on the shelf in your house and have good luck. Like I said, it's not the kitty cat with the little waving arm, right? It's not that. It's also not a textbook. It is a compilation of many different types of literature. There is epic poetry. There is music and singing. There is narrative. There is law. You don't read those things the same. If you do, that's stupid. You don't do that. You have to have enough intelligence to know, I don't read a legal book. Literally, you don't read the tax code the same as you read Tennyson. If you read them the same, you're going to misunderstand both of them probably. So you know the example I use of coming home and finding that Ginger has left me a love poem that says sandwich meat and diapers and toilet paper and eggs. And I'm like, man, what is she saying about our love when she writes about the toilet paper? What is she trying to communicate about? If you read something as the wrong form of literature, you're going to misunderstand it. The Psalms is not a book of promises. It's a book of poetry. There are promises woven into it. But it is King David or the other psalmist writing music about how they feel and what they're experiencing and about their specific situations. So is the writer of Psalm 121 claiming that God will never keep me, that he's never going to let me die? Do we really think that's what the psalmist thought when they wrote that? Was, hey, I'm going to be the one who lives forever. No, this is called a psalm of ascent. It is the song they would sing, one of the songs they would sing as they walked into the city of Jerusalem, as they went up the hill to Jerusalem. They would sing these together. How am I going to make it to Jerusalem? God's going to keep me safe on my way to Jerusalem. This is as much a prayer as a statement of fact. God, keep me safe as I walk into Jerusalem. If I make it there, it will be because you took me there. The context in this is very clear, and it doesn't take that much research to figure it out. It's not hard anymore. I was laughing with a pastor the other day who had just walls of commentaries on his bookshelves. And I was like, I bet those gather some major dust today, don't they? Man, what was it like when we had to study all the commentaries by having to own 30 volumes this big each of Bible commentaries? Now you can just go to Bible Hub, like I showed you guys. Like it's amazing. It's not that hard to do some research on these. Now, I'm not even an expert on the Psalms, but you could look this up and you could read through. The writer of Psalms is not claiming that God is never going to let you die. The next few Psalms all around it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense if that's what the writer of the Psalms is claiming. Because half the time the writer of the Psalms is saying, you're letting me die. So that's not what's going on here. And so to read it as a form of literature that it isn't is wrong and foolish and inconsistent. It is truth, but you can't understand what truth is being communicated if you don't understand the form of literature that it is. Otherwise, you think it's a book of promises from God when what it is a book of poetry about God, inspired by the Holy Spirit that we can learn from. But, I mean, how many of us, you know, you get disappointed when you read the book of Proverbs that says, one of my favorites, train up a child in the way they should go, and when they're older, they won't depart from it. That's a proverb. It is a book of wisdom. Generally speaking, that's true. But it's not some promise by God to say, listen, if you'll train up a child the way they should. First of all, no one manages to do that perfectly, right? Maybe God would say, hey, you train your child up perfectly and they'll do great. Don't mess it up. Don't do anything wrong with them and they'll go great. Well, hosed, right? But that's one of the ones he jumps to quickly. It looks like God's lying. Don't buy into that kind of picking and choosing of scriptures. He's only got about 10 scriptures that David likes to go to. I'll give you the other one that, yes.
So when you explain that to him, how does he receive it? What does he say?
He says, yeah, but what about slavery? Every time. During the first podcast that I was on with him, so I couldn't hear him sighing when he was on the first podcast. What did you put? Yeah. That's a hare, not a rabbit. It's time. I'm gonna wrap up this then, and we can talk more about this if you want to later. But here's the thing. I want to make sure you know, if you walked away, if you were here, or if you listened to it, if you walk away with something, you're like, I don't know how I would answer that. Like that left a hard, scary thing in me hearing him say this. Please ask me. I'm happy to have that conversation. I think the podcasts are more likely to create that in you than he did that Sunday. He was so off that Sunday. I mean, I almost felt bad about it. That's why I went back to him on that question of problem of evil. I'm not surprised. I am surprised that any atheist would post it on their site. I am not surprised that he would because he said he would. And he apparently doesn't mind it. Part of it is this is his business. And when he has 120,000 people downloaded, he makes some serious dough on that. And so part of that's there as well. One question before we wrap up was a... you could look me up on Facebook, and the links are on my Facebook. If you're on Facebook, the Dogma Debate podcast, I've asked him for copies of the originals so we can post them on our website. I think it's been long enough now he will do that because he's not going to lose any money by letting us post a free copy or post a link. Definitely the one from this last Sunday or whenever it was will be on our website soon if it's not already. Anyway... Please be praying for him, his family. He is in a hurt place right now. He has been rejected by basically both sides. When you try to take the middle ground, that just means both sides get mad at you, which is what he tried to do. Really, right now, the only people who are his friends, who are being faithful to be his friends right now, are a handful of his Christian podcast guests. And so he is very much so hurting right now. The timing was perfect for him to be in our church. That was very divine. I don't know why he was so off. I mean, it was, if you've heard the radio show and then you've heard him here, I don't know if it's just that his side isn't used to getting to losing the spiritual side, the spiritual warfare side of things as badly as I'm presuming his side was trying to come here. I don't know if it's just him. I don't know if he was out of it or if he's just feels terrible right now because of how he's very confused by how he's been treated by the other atheists. How many times did he say Sunday afternoon some version of that? Did you hear how often he would say, oh, well, the emails from your people will be a lot nicer than the emails from the atheists? Man, when your people are rejecting you and the people you've been an enemy to for 20 years are welcoming you and loving you, that is hard to ignore. Yeah?
I just want to mention, this guy is not new. He has an agent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's got a lot.
Yeah.
I've seen him on other media. So he has exposure.
His first book is about to come out.
And I'm sure he has some hate mail.
Oh.
This experience.
Yes. He had to shut down his Facebook recently because of the amount of hate he was getting from other atheists. So. No, before he came here. Oh, he had already had to do that, so. Yes. I don't have time to go into it right now. We're already late, but it's because he didn't take either side of a big fight that's in atheism right now. He tried to play the middle ground, and so they all hate him for it. So anyway, let's pray. Father, thank you so much for the chance to gather. Thank you for the power of your word. Thank you that you are a God of truth, that we don't have to be afraid of not having the truth, because if we're wrong about something, you would want us to know that and to change what we believe. Father, I thank you that we have the freedom to investigate, to learn, to grow, to study. I thank you that the faith that you have offered us is reasonable, it is rational, it is something that makes sense, it is something that we can wrap our brains around and really embrace and enjoy, as well as step out in trust in you the times when there is something that's bigger than us that we're not going to understand because it's so unique or because it's so special or because it's just mysterious. And that is awesome too, Father. And I thank you that you are a God who reveals himself and a God who hides himself. I thank you that you are not the God we would create, not the God that we feel comfortable with, a God who loves us and who engages with us and who listens to us and who teaches us and who shows us and helps us learn and grow. Thank you that you are a God who is ever present and who sent his Son. Thank you that we get to celebrate the truth of God with us. And that makes a lot of sense too. Thank you, Father, for what you're doing, what you've done. I pray for David and for his wife and for his two kids. And I pray that you would continue to pursue them as you clearly are. And that the people around them talking to them would continue to be great examples to them. I pray that we will have more in connection with him as a church, as you see fit, and that we will continue to be expanding the ministry that you have called us to so many other places and in so many other ways as well. But Lord, I thank you right now primarily for the truth and the comfort that it brings to know there is such a thing. Thank you for this in your Son's magnificent name. Amen.